Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Cliff Huddis for his take on important new developments in breast cancer clinical research, and he began our conversation by commenting on a vexing clinical question: the role of CYP2D6 measurement when tamoxifen is being considered as adjuvant treatment.
In San Antonio, two of the very large randomized trials that people are familiar with comparing tamoxifen against aromatase inhibitors were reanalyzed retrospectively, looking specifically at the tamoxifen arms and trying to determine whether germline CYP2D6 status had any bearing on the relative benefits of tamoxifen. And it just didn't in either of those arms. So let me say it even more plainly. CYP2D6 status did not allow clinicians to predict with any accuracy who benefited or didn't benefit from tamoxifen.
Interesting. I think there are a fair number of people who've been using it up to now. Do you think that's kind of over? Is everybody convinced?
It's not. I don't want to sound like I told you so, but this is one of those areas where there's been tremendous controversy, and many of our friends and colleagues have believed the story and used CYP2D6 testing to make treatment decisions. And as you know well, there was a commercial push to do CYP2D6 testing. I fought that. I was stridently opposed to it, and I was offended by the direct solicitation of patients to send in material for testing when they were given prescriptions for hormonal therapy. If you're not familiar with this, you may be aware that sometimes when patients sent their prescriptions to be filled at central pharmacies, those very pharmacies were then sending back request forms for germline testing for CYP2D6.
Wow, I had no
idea.
Yes.
And so I was deeply offended by that on many levels, as you can imagine. But the important thing is, it's not that it was a bad idea. It was a very important idea. It was a very defensible idea. The hypothesis was sound. But in the end, in the clinic, to change practice, especially when one's talking about potentially life-saving therapies, one needs real evidence, not just a wish. And what we had until these data were presented was mostly a wish. The mixed evidence that you're referring to was not the greatest evidence in either direction, neither for nor against, because what had been happening is people were doing little things like crossing within databases the writing of prescriptions for SSRIs that inhibit CYP2D6 against the tamoxifen prescriptions,
right,
to see whether they were going to predict rates of recurrence. But as you know well, that's pretty mediocre research from a scientific point of view. There are all kinds of potential confounders. And some of those studies were positive and some of those studies were negative, and it left us scratching our heads. If you were a believer, you looked at the positive and said, I have more evidence. But the highest level of evidence we're likely to ever get is that which was presented at San Antonio just now. These were clean data sets and well-studied, prospectively followed patients. And I think this is nearly a unique resource at this point. So I think the story is over.
What else is going on that you want to comment on?
Of course, the AZURE data. And here again, we've had exciting, I think, preclinical and some clinical hints that a bisphosphonate, whether it's zoledronic acid now or pimidronate before or the oral ones from a somewhat earlier generation, might not only or merely prevent the development or progression of bone metastases, but that they might actually serve to inhibit the invasion into normal tissues beyond the bone. And this could be, of course, because of a direct biological effect, and such an effect been postulated, or because bone harbors cells as a reservoir, and if you knock down the bone population, you delay or prevent systemic mets. There was an intriguing observation in one study of maybe a higher in-breast response rate when patients got a bisphosphonate along with their neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So against that backdrop, there's one prospective randomized trial that had been shown earlier, the ABCSG trial by Michael Nant, published in the New England Journal. It's a very interesting and positive result with some caveats. As you'll recall, it showed a reduction, a rather dramatic one, in progression-free survival, and it showed a reduction in events both within bone and, importantly, outside of bone. What was a little bit of a disappointment was that even with prolonged follow-up, it has failed to demonstrate an improvement in overall survival, and one would like to see that, but there are explanations for why that could be so. A bigger issue with the study is that it really enrolled a narrow cohort of patients not so typical of American early-stage breast cancer, and that is young women given ovarian suppression and hormone therapy almost entirely in the absence of any chemotherapy. So the results could be technically said to apply to a group of patients who are getting only hormone therapy in early stage breast cancer. And while we have some of those in the U.S. in the young age groups, we don't have that many. That said, the results from the AZUR trial were larger. They enrolled a much broader array of patients. A large number of them had received chemotherapy. And if there's a global impact of bisphosphonates, which is what you would have expected, on overall recurrence and on even survival, it simply did not emerge here at all. The closest they got to duplicating the ABCSG result was in a postmenopausal group of women, which might to some degree mimic what was seen in the premenopausal group. So that said, that was a subset analysis, and the definitive results of the trial have to be summarized as it was negative.
Now, the Austrian study that you mentioned also reported some data at San Antonio, just the follow-up, same basic findings that you just described. There were also another set of studies, ZFAST, studies looking at zoledronate with an AI letrozole that seemed to show maybe in some cases less recurrences. You know, you brought up this question of maybe there's a subset. You know, suppose you have a premenopausal patient who's going to get ovarian suppression or maybe a postmenopausal. Is this sort of a dead issue from a research point of view? And is it a dead issue clinically? Are we done with this?
I actually don't think we're done with this. As you know, there are several large and important randomized trials still not reported. And it's always tempting to, of course, go by the most recent result one sees. And for example, had the AZUR trial been reported first and the ABCSG trial second, we would have a slightly different mindset, I suspect, on this. So I try to be very open-minded. I don't believe this question is resolved completely at all. I think it remains important. And I think there are potential, for example, the RANK ligand inhibitor, the denosumab. Who knows how these other drugs might potentially be of benefit? And who knows if there aren't subsets like women with low estrogen environments who might be the ones who do benefit from this. I just don't know. What I do know is that clinicians should not, outside of trials, be recommending these therapies for breast cancer. It turns out that what I just said is less restrictive than it seems because, of course, a significant number of our patients have a bone health justification for a bisphosphonate anyway, and the schedules of administration for bone health maintenance aren't so different from what's studied in these trials. So we might be making much about nothing, but there is a deeper point which I would want to mention, and that is that our patients have anxiety and worry, and our patients have been struggling with whether they should push their doctors to give them a bisphosphonate. They've been losing sleep at night, worried that they're not getting this advantage when their doctor is conservative, and we certainly should reassure them that there's no evidence that anybody is missing anything right now if they don't get a bisphosphonate.
Another sort of sidelight issue that kind of I thought was a little bit strange, and one of the issues I think you mentioned was the fact that very few of the patients in the Austrian study got chemo. The vast majority received it, and as your one of the things was that there were like 17 confirmed cases of ONJ in the AZUR study, maybe some other ones, you know, not clear, and none in the Austrian study. Any clues as to why that might be?
I think, as you know, Neil, comparing results across clinical trials is rife with difficulty. One doesn't know the intensity of the scrutiny for ONJ, and I would really hesitate to say much or make much of that. I do want to mention one other small thing, which it's not related to this topic in terms of the bisphosphonates, but it is related to the theme of really being sure about what trial results are versus what you expect. The other hidden part of the ABCSG trial, I mean, hidden from popular perception, is it failed to show that the AI was better than tamoxifen. Now, mind you, all these patients have ovarian suppression, but if anything, the tamoxifen arm for these young patients has always looked better. And I mention that because, again, those worried young high-risk patients in many cases will push their doctor to make them menopausal, give them an AI, and while that could yet turn out to be better than just tamoxifen alone, here they compare it to the two active drugs in the setting of ovarian suppression. One doesn't have data for that, and your preconceived notion from the postmenopausal setting would have been that the AI is superior. So these are all very consistent bits of evidence for the wisdom and value of waiting for clinical trial results and not assuming too much.
What else has happened in the last few months or in the last year? I mean, obviously there's a huge number of things, but maybe we can just sort of keep going down the list.
We got increasing updates on the clear activity of TDM1, and many other, I have to say, not a few, but many other anti-HER2 drugs. And I think this has opened up a somewhat related kind of issue. There's a little bit of a controversy right now about T-DM1 and with regard to the lack of an accelerated approval for the drug. And I would just highlight the following. There's no doubt that that drug is active, and it's very likely that many other drugs are active. Some mTOR inhibitors, of course, some other pan-HER inhibitors, some HSP90 inhibitors. And I think the key thing to keep in mind here is in the HER2 field, and in all fields of breast cancer for that matter, demonstrating activity is a necessary step to getting a drug out there into use. But the truth is, nobody can answer the question, is a course or a window of exposure to T-DM1 necessarily better than the same course and exposure to, for argument's sake, salvage therapy with trastuzumab and vinorelbine, or salvage therapy with trastuzumab and lapatinib? I'm making a point which I hope is not lost here, which is not that I know that it's better to give standard therapy, but it's to say with all of these drugs, we're going to have a challenge as a community weighing the relative value of many options. And that's more difficult in the clinic. In a sense, it's a confined problem when one is talking about the regulatory environment, but that's what's going on right now. So, you know, I would have loved to see T-DM1 available, but I have an academic understanding of why that didn't come to be based on just a phase 2 non-randomized trial.
Although when you have a single agent, I guess maybe you can make an argument that it's a double agent, but when you have an agent that causes clear-cut responses in patients who've had very extensive prior therapy, you know, I guess you could make the argument you could bring back one of the old ones, or, you know, lapatinib, trastuzumab. It's very hard for us on the outside to really get a feel for this, but a lot of investigators who've used the drug say, you know, I wish I had it for a lot of patients. A lot of docs in practice are saying, you ask them if T-DM1 were available, how many patients in your practice would you use it for? Maybe it's misguided, but there's the feeling that this really, there's enough evidence to know that it really would help some patients.
Actually, that's exactly what I was getting at, and I'm probably not saying it elegantly enough. It's clearly active, and I think I would use it were it available. But my point is that one has to be somewhat careful about that argument, because one actually will have the ability to make that argument about a lot of options. And then you're going to get into subtle issues. You know, for example, neratinib, or neratinib and temsirolimus, or maybe the AKT inhibitors very shortly, or maybe the MEK inhibitors. I mean, one will see activity, and one will then have this subjective problem. In the case of T-DM1, you're exactly right. These patients were heavily pretreated, and these responses are not what we're used to. On the other hand, all of what's happening with HER2 is slightly different from what we've always expected with breast cancer. I mean, I have a patient I saw yesterday who I've been treating sequentially for HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer since October of 2001. This is not the natural history of ER-negative breast cancer in a bygone era. And this patient has benefited from experimental therapies. T-DM1's just one of the ones that this particular patient benefited from. And she's benefited from standard therapies, and she's benefited from unconventionally used standard therapies. So it just makes the point that this is a whole new field. And I guess it has to be a level playing field. So while I can sympathize with and maybe even agree with the idea that T-DM1 would have been great for approval, the problem with that is one has to be prepared to open that door pretty widely then.
You mentioned neratinib. Can you clarify, first of all, how neratinib differs from lapatinib, what clinical data we have, and what about other TKIs? There's one that we've been hearing a lot in lung cancer, BIBW, I think it's 2992, and I think that also has been looked at in breast cancer. Could you sort of put that all together?
Yeah, it may seem complicated, but in a sense, one can start by thinking of these three drugs as the same drug. If you start that way, they are oral tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and they have activity against the key tyrosine kinases that we think are important in breast cancer, HER1, HER2, and HER4. The issue is that, like all tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and one can go very broadly now, sunitinib, sorafenib, imatinib, and so forth, one ends up, in the case of these drugs, without precision. It's not like the interaction of an antibody to its target. And so they are often what we say is promiscuous. They have activity that can peak. For example, lapatinib has a peak in activity for HER2, but it has HER1 inhibitory effects. In fact, you'll recall that they targeted non-HER2 positive breast cancers and other diseases like lung cancer in the development of lapatinib originally. Erlotinib and gefitinib are other examples of these kinds of drugs. So these particular drugs that you're talking about, neratinib, VIBW, and lapatinib, they have a peak in activity against HER2. So while they're pan-HER inhibitors, they're a little more selective for HER2 than for some of their other potential targets, and that makes them potentially useful, as you know, in HER2-positive breast cancer. The second component of this is that there are compensatory regulatory pathways in breast cancer, in particular in HER2-positive breast cancer. So, for example, when one knocks down the signaling from HER2, one can see compensatory signaling via HER1 or via HER3. And so one starts to imagine that if one were able to put a kind of a wet blanket over the whole fire instead of over one corner of the room, one might actually do a better job at suppressing growth. And that's the simple theory behind all of these pan-HER inhibitors. Now, the specifics of it are, for BIBW, there's less data right now. There's some activity clearly reported. I believe the phase 2 study that came out of Dana-Farber had that activity last year. For neratinib, there's been a substantial amount of activity, relatively large phase 1 studies and phase 2 studies done in a variety of settings, single agent combined with trastuzumab, second line, you know, further along in terms of therapy. And I think the following would sum it all up. Lapatinib, as you know, has some single agent activity in the first line setting, and it clearly augments the activity of chemotherapy in the form of capecitabine after first line treatment with trastuzumab. Furthermore, the combination of lapatinib and trastuzumab is active in the deep salvage setting. The caution there being, of course, that all the patients got lapatinib. The randomized question was actually the reintroduction of the trastuzumab. That's a sidebar, perhaps. Neratinib is a single agent that has at least the same kind of activity as one is used to seeing with CAPE and lapatinib, or paclitaxel and lapatinib, or so on. So this is a drug with more toxicity in terms of GI and skin, and possibly more activity. What I'm really saying is that neratinib may just be a more potent version of lapatinib, and so much more potent that it may not combine with chemotherapy as easily as lapatinib has. How these really weigh out in terms of optimal use in the clinic remains to be seen. I'm currently studying with my colleague Surat Chandralapati at Memorial, temsirolimus and neratinib, the mTOR inhibitor. But we're not the only people doing that. I want to be clear. There are other similar trials. And the real notion here is that these drugs allow us to pick apart the pathway and hopefully shut it down. And the very best of these drugs, I don't think, is clear cut just yet.
As you were talking, I was thinking about those fantastic graphics that you and the New England Journal of Medicine artists did for the review article. Really, I think that's the best I've seen anywhere. Help me understand, you know, when I think about the BIBW compound, it's supposedly, quote, an irreversible EGFR inhibitor, you know, that's used in people with EGFR mutations in lung cancer. Where does that, or where does EGFR fit in with HER2?
Well, there are four members of the HER family, right? HER1, 2, 3, and 4. And HER1 is a synonym for EGFR. It's the same receptor. It's just two different names, essentially in two different contexts. It's sort of funny because breast cancer docs will say HER1, laboratory investigators will say HER1, but lung cancer and colon cancer docs and head and neck docs describe it as EGFR.
And HER2, though, is the target of trastuzumab?
Exactly. So HER2 is a target of trastuzumab, it's a target of lapatinib, and it's a target of a variety of agents, T-DM1, as we spoke about before, which after all is really a super trastuzumab, if you will. So HER3 has a natural ligand, but is not known to have its own tyrosine kinase activity, so there's not a HER3-specific tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And then there's HER4, which is another member of this family. Its role is less critical in terms of our day-to-day thinking about breast cancer. HER3, by the way, is an interesting one, which clinicians should be paying attention to, because there's evidence that it is upregulated also in HER2-positive breast cancers that have become refractory. Now, coming back to HER1, EGFR, one of the issues here is this is a target that was initially thought to be important across the range of human solid tumors, but it's probably less so, and it's critically important when it's activated through a mutation in lung cancer and in GI cancers through KRAS, I think, primarily. This whole pathway, KRAS and EGFR overexpression or activation or mutation has just not turned out yet to be critically important in breast cancer. We've done more than a decade of trials targeting EGFR. On my service, Andy Seidman in the 90s actually gave cetuximab and chemotherapy and did not find a signal that was particularly worthy of pursuit. More recently, Lisa Carey, Joyce O'Shaughnessy, Jose Bisalga have all reported studies in which cetuximab was combined with chemotherapy in randomized or sequential fashions, and there were little glimmers of activity, but the truth is it's never and still has not risen to the level of, I would say, proof of principle even. There are occasional patients who seem to respond even to single agent cetuximab, but you know in breast cancer that's tough because there are occasional patients who respond to almost anything. We've done single agent studies with the pan-HER inhibitors in the form of oral TKIs, so gefitinib's been given and erlotinib have been given in breast cancer, and again, there's just been no real signal here. So it's been, in comparison to HER2, it's been a disappointing and frustrating story, I would say.
Just to draw out this molecular model a little bit more, where does the mechanism of action of pertuzumab fit in?
Great. So trastuzumab, which is the archetype here, binds to the external portion of HER2, but down low near the cell surface. So if you picture for just a minute, and I credit Mark Lippman with this particular model because he's the one that described it this way, the antlers of a deer. So where the antlers come down and hit the skull is the cell surface. So trastuzumab binds to the receptor down near the skull surface, if you will. On the other hand, the dimerization domain, the part of HER2 that physically dimerizes with its partners, be it HER1, 2, or 3, typically in breast cancer, is higher up. It's not affected directly by trastuzumab, even though clinicians are often tempted to imagine that the trastuzumab's gumming up those works, preventing dimerization and preventing signaling. In fact, what happens is pertuzumab binds up top there. And that's a very important subtlety to get, because on that basis, you understand immediately why, A, it might work in trastuzumab refractory disease, it's binding to a different site, B, why the combination of two antibodies might be sensible, and that's what Jose Bisalga's reported and what Cleopatra has tested. The Cleopatra trial, of course, is docetaxel with trastuzumab alone or with trastuzumab and pertuzumab, both. So you have to ask, well, if you're targeting HER2 twice, how does that even make sense? And the answer is the mechanism is different. Again, coming back to the selectivity issue, the inhibition of dimerization was so significant as a preclinical observation that, in fact, the earliest studies with pertuzumab did not select HER2-positive cancers at all. They tried it as a pan-HER inhibitor across solid tumors, but its key activity does really appear to be in the HER2 positives. So maybe that's the thumbnail sketch of the system.
You mentioned Jose Bisalga's presentation, the NEO-ALTO study that was at San Antonio. Can you describe what they looked at, what they saw, what you think it means? And also the other study that kind of ties into what you're just talking about was the NEOSPHERE study looking at pertuzumab.
Well, there's a backstory here. And the backstory is that the adjuvant trials that we do, and especially now in HER2-positive breast cancer, are numerically challenged. We have to enroll thousands of patients to get a few hundred events. Comparing those events across arms of a study, this is an inefficient way to do drug development. It's a problem because we have to know that drugs are safe in the adjuvant setting. We have to know that they're effective. But getting to that point right now without doing these, 5,000 patient trials is a critical issue. So the neoadjuvant setting is proposed as a model to do this. And it's obvious what one would hope. One hopes that differentiating the response rate in the breast will accurately and reliably predict the impact down the road on disease-free survival and overall survival. That's the hope. One has to acknowledge that while that makes perfect sense and while there are examples where that's true, there remain examples where that has failed. And the most obvious example is in an unselected group of patients. If you were to test hormone therapies, you would discover that they almost never get you complete responses. And yet those patients who get hormone therapy for ER-positive breast cancer have the best outcomes. So there's a bit of an issue there for us before we get into the particulars. So
I think that's a good point. And, even in HER2-positive disease, there was a paper at San Antonio specifically looking at that, the TECHNO trial from Germany. And even though they did show what you talked about, that PATH-CR was correlated with, long-term recurrence, It wasn't that dramatic.
Well, the problem is in the other direction. Failure to get the complete response does not rule out a meaningful long-term benefit.
Right.
But, of course, the attraction is that every patient, 100% of the patients that you enroll in the pre-op setting provide biological data or scientific data. And one has to clearly contrast that with, take, for example, the North Central study or the BCRG adjuvant therapy trials. So you have 2,000-3,000 patients enrolled, but the vast majority of the patients who sign consent and get treated on those studies do not give you information because, lucky for them, nothing bad ever happens. So one can see how inefficient that is. And this is a real conundrum because people try to speculate. In fact, a few years ago, Joe Ragaz got up and basically said, from phase two activity, I can predict the results of phase three trials and adjuvant studies, blah, blah, blah. And I don't agree, but one understands his motivation there, which is, isn't it obvious that if one has an active drug, it will do X? And unfortunately, as we've been talking about, that's not always true. But that's the background.
Yeah, I was thinking about that talk when you were actually beginning out here today.
Yeah, so the neoadjuvant trials were all limited to HER2-positive breast cancer, and that does away with some of the concern because we're getting into a biologically consistent subset. Maybe that helps. And there were three of them. The first that you mentioned, of course, is NeoAlto. It's the companion to Alto. It provides matched tissue samples from patients who are on Alto, or on Alto-like therapy, rather. And it's really meant to inform and support and predict to some degree the results of Alto. As a reminder, Alto is a post-operative adjuvant trial of chemotherapy, followed by a year of trastuzumab, a year of lapatinib only. The sequence of some months of the lapatinib and then trastuzumab, or that combination for a year. The latter arm has been a concern because in earlier small pilot studies, including one of my own and one by Edith, there was a lot of GI toxicity for that combination, and so doses were adjusted. However, what Jose brought in the form of NeoAlto, and this is a similar design to one that we have ongoing in the CLGB, is several weeks exposure to just a biological agent by random assignment. So it's T, trastuzumab, L, lapatinib, or both, TL, three arms. And then they initiate the chemotherapy after a few weeks, but they're able to get a biopsy. And what they demonstrated is that the lapatinib and the paclitaxel lapatinib arm is no different numerically in response than the trastuzumab and paclitaxel arm, and that the combination of the three drugs looks best. One has to take a minute, though, and be patient about this and think about what this means. So the fact that the three-drug combination looks better than TH, which you would call the standard, bodes well, one hopes, for the adjuvant trial because it could be a predictor, an early indicator, that the three-drug arm of the ALTO trial will turn out to be the winner, and that's certainly what everybody's hopes are up about. It's supported a little bit by that funny study I referred to a moment ago in the salvage setting, the lapatinib and trastuzumab versus lapatinib alone. The fact that there was activity for those two anti-HER2 drugs in heavily pretreated patients who specifically had disease progression not once but multiple times in most cases on prior trastuzumab, that says that there's something going on when one really hits the pathway this way, and one would hope to see increased activity in the early stage setting, and that's what the combination arm of Jose's trial suggests. Now, there's another part to the story, and that is that omitting the trastuzumab and just giving lapatinib with paclitaxel, that may be just as good as trastuzumab, but there's no hook in that for patients. There's no reason to substitute TL for TH. It changes the toxicities. Perhaps one might speculate in the end less cardiac toxicity, but more GI and skin, but there's no signal that it's more active.
So you have a patient, well-informed, been out reading, has got 10 positive nodes in the adjuvant situation, grabs you by the lapels and says, Dr. Huddis, how about giving me adjuvant chemo trastuzumab lapatinib? I saw this NeoAlto study reported. I want to do everything I can to stay alive.
So we do not have data that this is safe or effective for these patients, and I don't do it.
Yeah, I think that's been a universal response in investigators. I almost wonder, though, even if you could be introducing, you know, a problem in terms of drug delivery by bringing in the lapatinib and maybe compromising given the chemo or something. I don't know if that could happen.
Well, you just don't know. You don't know. And there is GI toxicity with this. So I will be the first to do it if an adjuvant trial is positive. I would be willing to think about this for a pre-op patient based upon what we do know, which is the higher in-breast response rates, but What that means, I think, is unknowable.
Willing to think about it. That's interesting. So you'd consider it outside of study.
Yeah, this is the problem with giving you an inch. no, I really wouldn't. But I mean, I guess I'm not choosing my words carefully enough. We have a CLGB trial, which Lisa Carey is chairing, called 40601. It is virtually identical to the NeoAlto, with the exception that we don't have the drug-only run-in. It's just paclitaxel from the beginning with the three agents. And we've talked a lot about what this study means. And, you know, in the end, it doesn't mean as much as you think, because one, for these HER2-positive patients, the in-breast response rate is not all-determining. As we've mentioned before, failure to get an in-breast path CR does not mean that you're going to have a bad outcome. Two, in our study, everybody gets the full year of trastuzumab out back. So what we're talking about is one drug, the other drug, or both pre-op, and then standard trastuzumab for the duration. So it's impossible to really strongly believe that what we do in the pre-op setting for these patients is going to translate into anything out back. So I actually would be quite resistant to off-study use of the combination. And frankly, I'm getting the courage of my convictions as I speak. Because of the toxicity, I would discourage a patient from doing that outside of a trial when we know we have potentially curative therapy for them anyway, whether they get a 25% response rate in the breast, complete response rate, or a 50% complete response rate in the breast.
Let's finish out with the neoadjuvant studies, with the NeoSphere study that included pertuzumab. What did they look at? What did they see? And what do you think it means?
There are four arms in this trial: trastuzumab and the taxane, docetaxel, pertuzumab and the taxane, three drugs, trastuzumab and pertuzumab and docetaxel, and then an interesting fourth arm, which was no chemo, just the two antibodies. And this kind of is an echo of what we saw before. To start with the punchline, the three-drug combination, both antibodies plus docetaxel, had the highest in-breast response rate of about 46%. This was most clearly seen in the ER negatives, interestingly enough, where it was over 60%, and less clearly seen in the ER positives, where it was 26%. The second bullet point, apart from the three drugs being best, is that omitting the chemo clearly looked inferior. The in-breast response rate for just the antibodies was below 20%, and it was only 6% for the ER positives who got the two antibodies. And then the sort of the fill-in-the-gaps arms were the trastuzumab docetaxel or pertuzumab docetaxel arms, and they had, you know, respectable activity in terms of response rates, but they did look to be numerically inferior to the three-drug combination. So what does this mean? Well, it augurs well for the unknown results of the CLEOPATRA trial, which after all is the same essentially as two of the four arms here. It compares, again, trastuzumab with docetaxel alone or with the second antibody pertuzumab.
And that's first-line metastatic disease.
That is first-line metastatic, but that could be a practice-changing result, right, if it's positive and if it gets approved based upon that. So I think that's the key thing. The second is this reminds medical oncologists and the community and patients that chemotherapy may well remain a very important component of the cure for early-stage breast cancer if these results are predictive.
So now you've got, I believe, the big group talking about or maybe going to start an adjuvant trial, including pertuzumab. You have the BETH study out there looking at bevacizumab with trastuzumab chemo. You have NeoAlto cooking. Where do you think we're going to be in 3 or 4 years or 5 or 10 years? I don't know.
I think we're going to end up with chemo, less of it, but chemotherapy of some sort, maybe just a single agent taxane someday, I don't know. And we're going to end up with a combination of a couple of these targeted agents. And this is just, by the way, the first wave of these. One thing is that these are all antibodies targeting HER2 or TKIs targeting HER2. But what about when we start to roll in drugs that target the compensatory pathways that are upregulated in resistance, be that HER3 or AKT or mTOR and so forth? I mean, I think that it's very exciting.
There's a lot of excitement, particularly within the NSABP, about bevacizumab specifically in HER2-positive disease. Any thoughts about where that might be heading?
Obviously, I'm excited that the trial will be available to us. The preclinical argument was that HER2-positive breast cancers, when the HER2 signals actually do generate VEGF, which of course then binds to the VEGF receptor, and if we were to give bevacizumab, we would inhibit that additional growth stimulant from HER2-positive tumors. And so I share enthusiasm for that. In fact, I shared enthusiasm for studying bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting. So we have the BETH trial, which focuses on that group. We have the broader array of patients who go into the ECOG study that tested conventional dose-dense AC and taxane with or without Bev. But while we're waiting for those results, we do have sobering data from colon cancer. And because the bevacizumab story has not really been precisely subtype specific in breast cancer or breast cancer specific, I do think that the negative results in colon cancer are a sobering reminder that we can't presume to know these data until we actually get them. And I do say that because it's, again, akin to our earlier discussions about when we know what to do and when we should adopt. I would caution people, under no condition should people be getting bevacizumab outside of a clinical trial in the adjuvant setting.
So I got an email from an oncologist in practice asking about a case, and I want to make sure I ask you about it. This is from Dr. Derek Haslam, who's in St. George, Utah. 67-year-old woman, June 2007, has breast cancer, has a lumpectomy, has two positive lymph nodes. The primary actually is only 4 millimeters. ER negative, HER2 positive disease. She receives 4 cycles of AC followed by 4 cycles of TH, completes a year of trastuzumab, and then 2 years later, December 2009, complains of persistent left nipple discharge. Has a negative breast MRI, but itching in the nipple. Dr. Haslam convinces the surgeon to biopsy. She's now got an eroded nipple with Paget's disease, high-grade ductal carcinoma in situ with a small focus of intermediate to high-grade invasive carcinoma, 3 millimeters in dimension. Again, ERPR negative, HER2 positive. She gets a left-sided mastectomy, no residual invasive or DCIS seen, PET scan negative. So she's had a same-side recurrence with Paget's disease of the nipple, small degree of invasion, wants to know what he should do. Should he give her anti-HER therapy again?
So this is a 3-millimeter HER2-positive invasive recurrence. Forget about the rest of the non-invasive cancer for a minute. Salvaged with the mastectomy in a patient who already had lumpectomy, RT, and I presume an earlier axillary dissection with 2 positive nodes, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
I have to say, I wouldn't give her any therapy.
And would you like to kind of comment on why?
Yeah, because she's had good chemotherapy for this disease already. On the face of it, let me turn it around one other way to make it clear. Let's imagine she had no past history, and instead she had duct carcinoma in situ with a 3-millimeter focus of invasive HER2-positive disease. Presume it's node negative because the overwhelming odds are that such a tumor would be, right?
Right.
So what's the possibility that she's going to get a meaningful benefit from cytotoxic chemotherapy and an anti-HER2 therapy? It's a fraction of a percent, perhaps, or nothing.
Well, you know, that brings up a good question. Is it true that we have data on the size of a local recurrence and what the risk
of... No, that's why I posed it the way I did. One has to say, if one had no past history of breast cancer and had only a new cancer that was 3 millimeters in size, one would be hard-pressed to justify any kind of toxic systemic therapy. So by extrapolation, in this case, in the setting of DCIS, which suggests that this is a newly arising tumor, you can't be sure, but it suggests that, I would treat it the same way. And if you push me, I'll just point out that there's, of course, zero evidence that argues that there's a benefit for treating such patients anyway.
Well, that also made me remember a little or think a little bit about the data on what the prognostic impact is of local recurrence. And I'm not sure I remember seeing that specifically in HER2-positive disease. I think you see more local recurrence, but I'm not sure the prognostic meaning.
Most of the data for local recurrence is post-mastectomy, where it's clearly a poor prognostic finding. For in-breast recurrences after a lumpectomy, while it's generally a poor prognostic finding, there is unfortunately always the possibility that it doesn't reflect bad biology so much as, regrettably, inadequate surgery.
Let's talk about new agents in breast cancer, and I guess the most recently approved is eribulin. Any thoughts?
Well, that's another big story. You asked me earlier, what are the big stories this year? So Ribulin, of course, is related to the product of a sea sponge, and it's a very novel kind of antitubule agent, which I think the story here is most interesting in terms of drug development, because looking at this crowded field of somewhat similar drugs, and we were just having a discussion that highlights that, they designed a, I think, bold clinical trial for approval. And that is, they said, okay, docs, you're all arguing about all these different therapies, and we'll never get consensus about what the right salvage treatment is for heavily pretreated hormone refractory, largely hormone refractory patients. So we're going to call you on it, and you can essentially use one of a large, almost half dozen number of controls. We don't care, but we will randomize against your selected treatment of choice for these salvage patients or Ribulin. So you could give gemcitabine, capecitabine, vinorelbine, weekly paclitaxel, anthracyclines, hormone therapy, or supposedly best supportive care with the proviso that although that was allowed, nobody actually randomized against best supportive care. And lumping together all of those supposedly indistinguishable salvage therapies, they demonstrated an overall survival advantage for the patients randomized to Ribulin. To me, this is profound because it says, first of all, the choices we make, even in the salvage setting, can make a difference. There are choices that may impact survival. Secondly, all of our random haphazard salvage therapy may be inferior to a Ribulin. And I'm moved by this. To me, this is a very optimistic kind of a result. It says that we should not be dismissive or cavalier and that we should be thinking carefully. And I think a Ribulin probably deserves a fairly steady place in people's algorithms at this point because we don't have that many treatments that have been shown to change survival. And this is one of them now.